What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions like, why is it hard to get medicine you need in the Pacific?
It came to a point where he was admitted where he got blood poisoning. He needed antibiotics for that, and that was not available.
Join me, Scott Whitehair, on Polytalk.
Search up Polytalk in your favorite podcast app to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Liam Fox and welcome to Pacific Review. We'll take a look at the big stories from the region over the past week. Coming up, legal action in Micronesia over oil leaked from a World War II shipwreck, questions over the solution to Tonga's fuel crisis, and a little bit of soccer history made by American Samoa's national women's team. We'll have more on those stories coming up. This program is brought to you from the lands of the Yagara and Turrbal people. First, a hidden crisis is unfolding in Australia's flagship Pacific Development Program known as the PALM Scheme, with workers leaving their Australian employers over abuse and exploitation. Some of these workers are now undocumented, unemployed and homeless, and many are now finding refuge in rural communities around Australia. Lucy Cooper visited the town of Leeton in New South Wales and filed this report.
I was left with nothing.
It was supposed to be an opportunity to save money for school and support her family in the Solomon Islands. But instead, Susan Pinu found herself in dire circumstances.
I feel, sad.
She came to Australia under the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility PALM Scheme, which aims to address labour shortages in rural and regional Australia. It's often described as a win-win, filling jobs in agriculture, meat processing and aged care, while providing income for Timorese and Pacific Islanders. But the scheme has been criticised for putting its participants in danger of exploitation. For Susan, work was inconsistent. She moved to four states in just 9 months, and her take-home pay was too low because of excessive deductions.
If someone pick fast, they're going to get everything, but if you pick slow, you have nothing. Sometimes we're going to left with $100, $200.
Susan left her employer, a labour hire company, and she's not alone. More than 7,000 PALM Scheme workers have disengaged in the 5 years since 2019, a decision which puts some of them in breach of their visa conditions.
We heard all kinds of stories from people who'd left the PALM Scheme, some really harrowing accounts of, abuse and exploitation.
Dr. Kaya Barry is from Griffith University. She's among researchers from three universities who have put out a new report looking at the work and living conditions of disengaged workers.
We saw several pay slips that people showed us where they'd receive zero take-home pay, zero net pay. They're largely being exposed to situations that are equivalent to modern slavery. So they have no legal status in Australia. That means they have no support for Medicare, for work cover, for any kinds of rights that everybody else here, either on a temporary visa or an Australian citizen, has.
She said PALM Scheme workers arrive with visas tying them to one employer, and they face barriers to changing jobs if they encounter problems at work.
A lot of the workers that we've spoken to have felt that they were just unable to ask for changes, whether that's changes just to the role or the kind of work they're doing, or changes to their location in where they work.
One former PALM worker, Wayne Levy, left his employer, a labour hire company, over concerns about excessive deductions and low pay.
There is no transparency regarding our payment. We don't know what's going on. All the deduction, we don't know what we deducted for. At the end of the day, I just received, 200 and 300. So I can't support my family. I have kids back home and they have to attend their education and I have to plan, I have to meet for the future. So when I receive this sum of money, it's like a pain in my body. Yeah.
He's since gained a bridging visa, which allows him to work on a citrus farm.
See, this is a good opportunity. I come and show the citrus farm. Yeah, it's a good money here.
He ended up in the New South Wales Riverina town of Leeton.
I love Leeton. I want to stay here for the whole of my life. If I can get my family here too, it would be great, yeah.
The sun-drenched horticultural hub is home to fruit and rice-growing industries that fill supermarket shelves across Australia. It's here that community leaders have seen an influx of workers looking to make ends meet.
People aren't becoming disengaged here in Leeton. They're disengaged before they come to Leeton. So they come here seeking friendship, connections, and some opportunities to work.
Paul Matem leads the town's multicultural support group. He also served as the local mayor for 16 years.
We can't walk away when we see people that maybe haven't been treated fairly. They don't really know where to go. They're frightened. They don't have any real connection. So we fill that gap.
He was pivotal in creating the reputation Leeton has today, one of acceptance and safety.
We don't have a brick wall around our town, and we never will. There'd be a huge void if suddenly they all had to go home.
Do you get paid for the work that you do?
No.
Why do you do it?
Well, in a nutshell, I care. So I care about people, and I certainly feel that I have an obligation. And certainly when I retired from mayor, I certainly didn't retire from care.
Susan Pienaar didn't return home after leaving the PALM scheme. Her family needed financial support and she feared violence from someone she knew back home. She too found herself in Leeton after forming a relationship with a former PALM worker and falling pregnant. Soon after giving birth to her daughter, Angela, there was a breakdown in the relationship.
In that time, like, after everything, I feel like commit suicide. Yeah.
She found support from a Leeton family who gave her accommodation and community workers who helped her obtain a bridging visa, letting her study aged and disability care.
That's bring me like, that's comfort bring me like, oh, I'm someone.
Paul Matem said many former PALM workers who are pregnant go months without medical care.
The worst case I've seen is one woman 8 months pregnant has never been to a doctor, remembering they've got no health cover. They've got nothing there to give them any cover, so they just turn up.
Leeton Mayor George Weston is proud of the culture Leeton has, but warns everything has a tipping point.
We go out our way to try and help these people, it's not a burden. It can be a burden if it left for go too long. If more and more people come here, we need really help from the federal government, you know, to help us with these people who've been disengaged to back into working again.
Leeton Mayor George Weston ending that report from Lucy Cooper. An expert on maritime law says a lawsuit in Federated States of Micronesia may provide additional incentive for the international community to do more to deal with the environmental risks posed by World War II shipwrecks. The Casilele Press reports locals in Chuuk State have filed a lawsuit in the Supreme Court seeking to assign responsibility for the damage caused by an oil spill from the wreck of the Japanese warship Rio de Janeiro Maru in September. The complaint alleges brownish-orange oil contaminated mudflats, mangroves, fishing grounds and caused the deaths of four people, for which the plaintiffs are seeking wrongful death damages for their families. The governments of FSM, Japan and the United States are named as defendants, along with a dive boat operator alleged to have played a role in triggering the spill. Professor David Rothwell from the Australian National University says while any potential legal obligations will likely fall on the FSM government, the case could spur more diplomatic and political pressure for greater action on dealing with wartime shipwrecks.
The law of the sea provides the general framework and the background here, but ultimately the marine pollution that's arising as a result of the oil leakage from the vessel is really occurring within the waters of the Federated States of Micronesia. That means that the core obligation with respect to cleanup, with respect to the environmental damage and the pollution arising, it really rests with the Federated States of Micronesia. So it doesn't immediately have international implications, though of course it has international connections, given it going back to events arising from World War II, and that this is a Japanese warship that was sunk during World War II. But it's really very much relating to the events in and around and associated with the September 2025 oil spill.
Given that, what do you think the likelihood of either the US and Japanese governments getting involved, responding, or even being part of this action, do you think?
Yeah, no, I think we need to make a distinction here between the legal obligations of the United States and the Japanese as opposed to whatever responsibility they might accept with respect to any cleanup actions which might arise irrespective of the outcome of these particular proceedings. So it may well be that as a result of the prominence being given to this particular event, the American and Japanese governments might step in to provide additional levels of assistance to the Federated States of Micronesia with respect to the oil contamination and the cleanup process. But in terms of legal obligations, my initial thought is that this very much sits with the local government in terms of how they're responding to this known potential issue arising from the wrecks that are located within Chuck Lagoon, and the fact that at face value, the government hasn't necessarily taken appropriate action to ensure that any potential oil spillage from those known wrecks hasn't been contained, certainly in relation to the events of September 2025.
It's an interesting case in that, as you said, there's this overlap of historical and current issues. We spoke to you last month about the oil spill itself and the obligations of states like the Japanese and the United States to help clean up this spill. You said at the time it's a grey area. Does the fact that these wrecks have now caused some damage, including allegedly four deaths, does that change at all now that these wrecks, there has been an impact from these wrecks being left there for decades?
It doesn't really change the legal situation as it exists at the moment. It still remains a grey area. But what it does do is that it creates an additional political and diplomatic incentive to try to get some of these issues resolved. And to that end, the international efforts to try to get a clearer international legal framework with respect to these historic wartime wrecks hasn't really advanced very far. But the prominence being given to this case will provide additional incentives to try to get some resolution of these issues moving forward.
Given what you've said about how this is largely a domestic issue relating to the responsibilities of the FSM government to deal with these wrecks and the pollution that has now come from them, you think there's little to no chance that either the US or the Japanese will get involved in the court case or could potentially at some point in future be found liable?
Well, certainly both the United States and the Japanese will be very concerned about any legal precedent being created. So it may well be that they might become involved in this civil case, if only just to protect their own interests. But given the potential for these issues to arise all throughout the Pacific, I think both the Americans and the Japanese will be keen to ensure that there's no real legal precedent set here, which creates significant ongoing obligations for them.
Maritime legal expert Professor Donald Rothwell from the Australian National University speaking there. The traffic is flowing again in Nuku'alofa, but it was a different story recently, with long lines forming at service stations as Tonga's capital was rocked by a fuel shortage. While the issue may be resolved for now, there are concerns it's only a temporary fix, with an ongoing storage problem likely to cause more trouble in future. However, there could be a silver lining to the country's fuel troubles, as Finau Fanua reports.
Long queues of vehicles lining up to refuel at a petrol station. It's something Tongans have grown used to. Sporadic fuel shortages have led to petrol stations shutting their doors to customers, with only a handful staying open for business. Fuel shortages have occurred in the last 3 months, with many drivers forced to wait for hours.
I waited for more than 2 hours just to get enough petrol to last us a few days. It was extremely frustrating.
Tonga's Prime Minister Aisake Eke urges the public to be patient and to be economical. He said an ongoing maintenance operation of the country's fuel depot was the cause of the sudden fuel shortages, and that a strategy plan to increase storage capacity and introduce electric vehicles was currently in place to avoid future disruptions. The fuel disruptions has the public frustrated.
It was learning to allocate time and resources and only go to places that were essential and no more going to unnecessary road trips.
The fuel shortages have also been a burden for businesses.
We affected by that, not run much during the day.
Reniti Dhamma is the owner of the Friendly Taxi Tours, a popular taxi company in Tonga. She's refused to increase taxi fees, taking a hit on revenue.
So now most of our colleagues at the airport try to fill up a tram to save their home before run out of petrol.
But there's a silver lining to Tonga's fuel woes. In this 1980s video, a family rides via horseback in Nuku'alofa. During those times, walking and horse riding was the main form of transport in Tonga. But as Tongans' overseas diaspora grew, so did remittances and the importation of vehicles. According to the Ministry of Infrastructure, there were over 3,000 vehicles in Tonga in 2024. A conversation has been happening. Many complain there are too many vehicles and that people just need to walk more. Tonga's fuel crisis could just be the thing to drive the public towards healthier living, more affordable living, and a cleaner environment.
But now for Nua with that report. More than $500 million of funding has been approved for two massive development projects in the Pacific by the World Bank and the Asian Development Bank. $200 million will be used to build a long-awaited 720-metre bridge in Tonga that will create a second transport corridor for the capital, Nuku'alofa. A second grant of $360 million will fund the Pacific Healthy Islands Transformation Project to tackle non-communicable diseases and modernise health services in Fiji, Kiribati, Tonga and Tuvalu. The ADB's Regional Director for the Pacific, Aaron Batten, says they are the first Pacific projects to be approved under a partnership between the two lending institutions.
ADB's been supporting the preparation of this project in Tonga since 2019, and its origins really went back to some of the resilience and disaster impacts that have affected Nuku'alofa over the years. What the project does is helps to ease urban traffic congestion by creating a secondary access route into the city, but also to promote long-term urban resilience by allowing and opening up higher bits of land on Nuku'alofa. The project also supports large improvements in drainage and flood protection for the existing road network.
And this is a grant financing, not a loan, is that right?
The project will be supported with $140 million in US dollars funding in grant, and that will be provided by the ADB, the World Bank, and by the government of Tonga itself. The funding is being mobilised under our new joint partnership with the World Bank, which means that the government of Tonga only needs to follow a single set of procedures, with the ADB acting as the lead financier. And what this does is help to streamline the bureaucracy required and allow us to deliver the funding quicker and faster to deliver impacts to the people of Tonga.
Has the land been secured for the projects? Has all that been finalised?
As part of this project, we've been supporting the government on all safeguards requirements, including community consultation, land acquisition, environmental protection, and that work will continue throughout the lifespan of the project, which we expect to take another 2 to 3 years to complete.
The Pacific Healthy Islands Transformation Project, what are the details there?
Yeah, the Pacific Healthy Islands Transformation Project is spread across four Pacific countries, so Fiji, Tonga, Tuvalu, as well as Kiribati. The project will have a number of key outputs for the region, including revamping service delivery models across all four of those Pacific countries. This will particularly focus on non-communicable diseases, but also strengthening health systems and approaches so that all Pacific countries can upgrade their health system delivery.
Does that mean better training, better equipment, better facilities?
All of the above. The program will place a particular focus on training and skills development. Up to 10,000 health workers will be supported through the delivery of the program.
If, say, that this the Tonga Bridge project, for example, was being funded under previous arrangements before this partnership, well, you'd have two organisations financing it. The Tongan government would have then have to deal with two separate loads of bureaucracy, paperwork, all that sort of stuff. Now they're just dealing with one.
Look, in the Pacific, ADB and the World Bank have always had a very close relationship, and we've always done our very best to harmonise how we work with our Pacific counterparts and to streamline. But yes, there was always a dual reporting requirement and some dual processing requirements when it came to our co-financing. What the new arrangements allow us to do is to select a lead financier, and then those policies and procedures of the single institution apply. So the Pacific government only has one partner to deal with rather than two. So this will significantly reduce the workload and compliance on our Pacific governments.
That's the Asian Development Bank's Regional Director for the Pacific, Aaron Batten. Finally, to sports, and more soccer history has been made in Rarotonga, where American Samoa's national women's team have made it through to the second stage of FIFA World Cup qualifying for the very first time. As Richard Hewitt reports, the result is a true landmark for a federation which has faced some humiliating losses in the past and always struggled against the odds on soccer's world stage.
American Samoa came into the tournament having never scored a World Cup goal, let alone won a game. But after netting three to defeat Tonga, they went one better against Cook Islands after laying on what could easily be the best ever performance by a team from the US territory.
Mafala, through it comes. Patea, it goes in, and American Samoa take the lead in this all-important match. Sensational finish from Morgan Patea. American Samoa lead 1-0. Manao, their captain, with a shot and it goes in. Second goal for American Samoa. Manao, the most capped player of all time for American Samoa. Paretta's waiting for it and Summers again accelerates through, just showing her pace. Links up with Mafala, who brings it around, and Mafala gets it done. Third goal here for American Samoa. The Mafala sisters working in tangent to get the third goal for American Samoa. Patolo up high looking for Drago. Here comes the header. And lovely shot to the back of the net from Summers. Fourth goal here for American Samoa. Well, if there's someone that deserves a goal here, it would be Summers. She's done so much hard work. And that's it. American Samoa can celebrate. They're going through to the second round of the Oceania qualifiers. What a wonderful performance from them.
And it was the scorer of American Samoa's fourth goal, Matten Summers, who was chosen as player of the match.
This is just the first step in making history. We worked as a team and it took us a little bit to get settled into the game, but I think we just gritted it out and we played with a lot of heart.
Coach Amanda Cromwell has an Olympic gold and a World Cup bronze medal to her name, having played 55 times for the United States. She also has decades of experience coaching in the US college system and the National Women's Soccer League. But the scale of her achievement with American Samoa has really stirred her emotions.
What a day for American Samoa and these players, the federation. So many resources have been put towards putting together this team in a short amount of time. And I'm just so proud of the effort. I'm so proud of the competition. Everyone played their hearts out. What a great event. All the resources we had in performance and all the metrics we were given and everything from ice baths to yoga for the recovery, it was first class.
Cromwell's opposite number, Rhys Rucker, was in awe of his opponents, and he says his Cook Islands team have a lot to learn.
We're playing against a very good team, and it's clear that they're operating at a high level in terms of the intensity and physicality. Our girls aren't. That kind of showed today. But from minute 50 to 95, I thought we were good value, real good. And that's a credit to the girls for being extremely physically and mentally fatigued, but continuing to go.
So now American Samoa head to Honiara early next year to take on local rivals Samoa, New Zealand, and the host Solomon Islands in round two of World Cup qualifying. And based on the form they have shown in Rarotonga, Amanda Cromwell's team can't be taken lightly. Their success, built in almost no time at all, is based on casting their net wide in the search for talent overseas. The result is a squad which right now includes only three Ireland-based players, with the rest from the United States. But the coach says that's a situation which can change over time.
It's been amazing going down that discovery with the Federation, getting everyone together that we can find that has the eligibility and the ancestry to represent the island. And some players don't know that they are eligible to represent certain countries. And that's huge. And I think because we're getting stronger, obviously, and we just qualified for stage two, now that's going to inspire all the girls on the island to, hey, look at this team, look what they're doing. And now we're going to have even more players from on the island. Just the recognition and the participation. It's all about opportunity, right? And now we have an opportunity to keep building this federation. And I'm so proud to be leading the way.
Richard Hewitt reporting on the rise of American Samoa's national women's soccer team, with plenty to look forward to in 2026. And that's it from Pacific Review. I'm Liam Fox. Thanks for listening, and do join us again at the same time next week for more news and views from around the region. This program is broadcast from the lands of the Yagara and Turrbal people.